session number 18580, Reel 6.
Andy Allen, Reel 6. I just asked you why you thought that these carpos had a homosexual relationship with the Jewish boys.
Well, any man must have a feeling about that, I would think. I've been at sea with man, I've soldiered with man, and you can sense. I think you can sense, or should be able to sense, if there's something iffy. And the carpers always stuck together. And the little boys used to go back. They had a separate place. They didn't sleep in the huts with the ornery Jews. They had a little place for themselves. So I don't know. Maybe it's my bad mind. Maybe. But if I was willing to bet, I would say I thought they were. Does that answer your question?
Yes. Did you see anything of any of the more notorious heads of Auschwitz?
Yeah.
Who did you see of those?
Almagetti.
Who?
Almagretti. IRMAGRESCA.
Any others?
Yes. The man with the dogs. What the devil was his name? Yeah. There was Mengele's, Dr. Mengele's. And I've told you before about Almagretti. What did I say the name of the man was?
Kramer, did you say?
Joseph Kramer. J-O-S-E-F-K-R-A-M-E-R. Joseph Kramer.
What? I think he could spell.
I know, but that's German. A German. I'm spelling a German.
But what do you remember about these individuals?
That they were very, very bad to the Jews. Very bad to Jews. Alma Gretchen used to go about with a whip in her hand. And she used to irritate the Jews until they did something or maybe said something, and then they used to get a whipping. But we didn't have a lot to do with them, because I think myself that they didn't want no truck with us, because maybe we were too fiery for them, and they didn't have enough hold over us like the SS. But I seen them.
Any memories of Mengele?
Yes. As I said before, I was friendly with the Polish underground. And they used to say that on a Tuesday, he put the Jews up on parade. And he used to walk down the lines, in between the lines, carrying a riding crop. And he used to touch him on the shoulder, and that man was for the gas chamber on Thursday. That's what the Polish underground told us.
I think that you heard some second-hand account of what was happening at Treblinka.
Yes. The underground again, the Poles again, they said, well, I was a worse camp than this. And I said, no, you can't have any worse than this. He says, oh, yes, nobody came out alive. And I says, what camp was that? And he said, the camp Treblinka. T-R-E-B-L-I-N-K-A, Treblinka. And I said, well, come on, tell me about it. He said, all the educated Poles and men with authority were rounded up when Warsaw was cleared out, and they were put in this camp. at Treblinka. That's only hearsay. It's only hearsay that I'm telling you now, because this man was telling me, and he said that the graves were dug 5 meters deep, which to me is 16 feet near enough. 16 feet deep, and as they killed them, they laid them head and foot in these graves. When that level was full, they used to lime it over the top and earth. And they did that until the whole grave was full with the dead poles. And they built a earth on top and let it settle. That's coming to me. And I've heard it 2 or 3 times. So I don't know whether it's the truth, absolute truth, or whether it's...
What language did you communicate with the Poles in?
Oh, the Poles used to speak English. The Poles that dealt with me spoke English. And we had now and again a bit of German, which I had to pick up to help me on my way for picking up stuff in barter. And a bit Polish. I knew a bit Polish. And between us, we used to work it out.
Now, coming back to the march westwards, can you tell me what happened to you on that march?
Yes. When we started the march, we come out of Auschwitz and started marching. And then the Germans arranged for an hour's march and 10 minutes rest, which suited us all right for a start, because we weren't very fit then. We had been short distances, but we didn't have the marching. They were back. But after being in the march for about a week, 10 days, Andy Porteous said, "I'm going to see Mieser." That was the sergeant major, German sergeant major, who was in charge of this march. So Andy went and seen him, and he come back and he told us. He says, "I've arranged with Mieser." He says, "Instead of an hour's march and 10 minute rest," he says, "I've asked him to make it a 2 hours march and 5 minutes rest." He said, "Now, if that doesn't fit in, we'll have to get you taken onto the horse and carts and taken away. You get into hospital or something like that. What do you think about it, boys?" We said, "Yes, come on, let's go." Well, we were equipped for winter time. We had British Army gear, British Army boots, and we were ready for the job. So we started this 2 hours march, 5 minutes rest. And then we used to have the Germans running up after us. "Help, help, hey, hey." So we walked them off their feet, literally. And then when this cart took the lads away with the bad feet, there was horses in them. And when the horses went lame, they said, "Well, we'll kill him and give you the meat." So Andy Porteous again came to me and he says, "You were a fisherman. You've got the things." I says, "Yes." He says, "Well," he says, "I've got a London chap down here," and he says, "he's a butcher. He says, will you help him with the horses?" "That's what we're doing." He says, "killing them and eating them." So, no other to do. I says, "Right, I'll help him." So, we got the first horse, and I remember that first horse. It had a lovely black coat and a white blaze in its head. So, this sergeant major, this German sergeant major, he took us down there. And he says, "a rope there, put it around the horse," he says, "take it through a tractor wheel and pull his head right down and kill him." I said, "what with?" And he handed me a hoe, a Dutch hoe, with a blunt end. I said, "you can't kill a horse with that, man." He says, "Andy Porter says, you're the butchers." So I says to this London chap, I said, "well," I says, "I'll knock him down if I can't." if you cut his throat. So he says, I'm not that sort of butcher, he says. I get the meat ready for the customers coming in and the shop. And I said, oh, I'm in trouble. So my mother's people, just be good luck. My mother's people had been slaughtermen. And when I was young, I used to go to the slaughterhouse and clean out the bladders, and I used to get a shilling a week for this. And I knew a little bit about it. Not much, a little bit. When you knock a horse down and cut his throat, in there, there's five veins coming into one. And this is the vein that you cut. When you see a slaughterman going in and nipping the throat and putting a knife in, that's just where he goes. He takes the vein and lets him bleed into a tray to death, and then they make black pudding through the blood. So, I said, well, I says, we're beat. Got to do something. I said, what the hell do I do? So I says to him, look, you take this rope and you pull his head right down. So when he did that, I hit him. I hit this horse on the forehead, and he dropped. So quick as a flash, I said, well, one way or another, I slit his throat, I put my hand inside, and I felt for his conglomeration of veins. I didn't know where they were, but I just felt until I said, that'll be them. So I nicked the, put a knife through them, and he bled to death, this horse. Kicked a bit and bled to death. So I says to him, do you know anything about a horse at all? He says, no, that's the butcher lad from London. He says, no, he says, I tell you, Andy, I put the meat up for the customers to come in and buy. I said, oh my God. So I'd seen, when I'd been in the slaughterhouse with my cousins, I'd seen how they did it. So I rolled this over on his back, I pulled him over his back, and I knocked his feet off from the bone, the hock. I says, right? So cut up the stomach, start appearing up, ticking down the side of the legs, and got his coat off, got his jacket off. Hey, are you with me? But roll them over. I got some fresh straw. I said, get some fresh straw and we'll roll them over, because we don't want the meat contaminated, made a mess of. So we rolled them over, and I knocked his head off. I cut his head off. Somehow or other, and I got this horse lying there without a jacket, his head cut off, and just meat. So as a German officer came in, and he says, who killed the horse? I says, me. He says, have you done it before? I says, no. He says, how do you know what to do it? So I told him. He was an interpreter with her. He did an interpreter with her, and he said, very good. He said, well, he said, save a good cut for me. And he walked away. I said, you've got a hope. So when I cut up this animal, I left him for the next day, and then hacked him up one way or another. Don't ask me how. Hacked him up and put the meat to the cooks. But by that time, I was stinking of horse blood, horse urine, stink of horse, and I every time I smelt a horse, I was coking. However, I'm going through my story now.
You are.
So Tom Chisholm says to me, he says, any extra meat down there on this? Well, there's a heart and there's a liver. He said, can we get that? I said, pleasure. Take it out of my hands, take it away. So the cook said, well, we'll cook here, and we were cooking in steamer units, where the fire was underneath, the water was in the steamer, and there was a handle in the steamer, big handle. And when it was cooked, you took it out. So we piled in, well, they did, not me, they piled in so much meat, so much veg. And it went. And they made a sort of soup that I couldn't look at. I couldn't look at it. I said, no. So I did that. And then there was, used to be a little sergeant major come down, and he used to come down the column shouting, Alan, Aberdeen, Alan, Aberdeen. Now she said to him, oh, not another bloody horse, Tom. And that's why I did the killing. So that man will tell you, if you get hunting, I'm again, that man knows me, must know me, because I did the killing for the column.
This is the contact I've given you, Jack Driscoll.
Yeah.
Any other memories of the march?
Oh, yes. I said to you that the Jew boys got a head start from us. Well, when it came to the colonnade, you just had to, when you were on pause, that was a rest, you went and did what you had to do. And this time, I went in the forest a bit, and I seen this Jew boy here. He was still alive, just. And he'd sat down to obey the call of nature, and his knees had been locked up with the frost, and his whole body was frosted. And this German corporal, it was then time for the Jews to move on. And this German corporal was one shot. So he come up to me and he says, have you seen a Jew? And I says, one in there, thinking that you take the man and sort him out. But he didn't take the man. He put the Luger at the back of his head and just poof, left him where he was.
Could you forage for food on the way, or were you just given food?
We stole food. They had big potato clamps. We went through a big potato growing area on the way, and the big potato clamps. But the outside of the potato clamps was frozen. And we had Welsh miners there, and they dug into the clamps. And they were coming out with packs and kit bags full of potatoes, lugging them, and then we're roasting fire. We're always at a fire at night. Well, a lot of fires at night, and we threw this potatoes on the fires and let them roast, and eat them when we're roasted.
Did the guards try to stop you doing it?
No. No. You see, the guards were beginning to get a bit afraid then, because they knew exactly how the war was faring. And they thought to themselves, well, if we are awkward with these lads now, there's a chance that we'll get knocked off, which was quite possible. Quite possible.
So where did you end up?
Regensburg. Regensburg. We finished up in a state farm there, Greyburg State Farm. We heard the guns firing, and we heard the shells coming over the top of us while we were in Regensburg. And we've seen the honey tanks, the American honey tanks. That's the small tanks, more a reconnoiter thing. And they went up past us. And they said, all right, boys, make your own way home. So we said, home? How can we get home? Yes, right away, a car. We need a car. Where can we get a car? The police have got a car. So we went down to the police station, and we pinched the car at the police station. Before you reach Regensburg. I, along with the rest of them, got this car back to the big farm. And I had 2 days previous, with this man in charge of the state farm, I had offered, we had Deutschmarks by that time, and I offered to buy a pig to roast, to kill and roast for the boys, to give them something to eat. No, he wouldn't do it. SS, he said, the SS will kill him. So when we got back with this police car, I says to the one of the lads, I said, I'm going for a pig. I said, I'm coming with you. So we went and we selected a big pig, and we killed it on the spot, and stuck it on a barbecue. We got two metal bars they got at each end, and a big rod in between, wooden. And we kept turning it and turning it and turning it. And everybody had, well, not everybody, but quite a few of the lads had a good feed that night. I had no sympathy for them, it wouldn't help himself. Because after all, we had to help ourselves. And then Tom Chisholm, the man that mustered with me, he went down to town next morning. He came back with a brand new Opel. I said to Tom, where did you get that car? He said, it's a German doctor's car. Well, the Stabsatz were still across the windscreen. Deutsche Stabsatz. I says, and what happened? He said, well, he says, I just asked him if he'd treat Germans, yes. Treat British Tommies, yes. Treat Jews, no. He says, so I just ordered him out the car. He said, and there's the car there. And that's how Tom got his Opel. Certainly, it was theft, but we were running amok then, because we were in charge. So we go back into Regensburg with this white police car, and we got stopped by the Yankee snowdogs, taken into this barracks where they were. So a Yankee major came down, and he says, who owns that police car? Of course not. So he says, we do. He said, well, I'll tell you what I'll do, boys. He said, I'll get you flown home if you leave me that police car. Oh, it's a fair swap for the lot of us. Who owns that oval? Tom says, well, I claimed it. He says, well, he says, that'll do my captain. He says, now, come on. I'm going to get you drafted onto a train in France. This time we're just off over the border from France. Took us over the border, and they put us in a train in France, and they took us up through France for 2 days and two nights. We knocked off at night, and we stayed there. And then we went to Le Havre. When we went to Le Havre, we found a big difference. We're back in the bosom of the British Army. So we were no longer in charge of nothing. They were in charge of us. So at Le Havre, where the Germans had built over the cliffs, the runway, they dropped the dune layer and built over the cliffs to give them enough runway to get the bombers off. So we got started in the 32s and went on one of the Dakotas, the Ducks, and we were standing watching there. We were second in line. And then she seen this duck running up, and then it vanished, went over the edge and fell. I says to Tom, I'm not going in there. I says, I'll go home by boat. But then we heard the engine still running, and it picked up. Seen it coming up. I said to Tom, I said, look at it, flying. So we get in there. From there, we went to Hayward's Heath, Sussex. Hayward's Heath in Sussex, we've got D-Lows there, we've got a good feed, we've got a new uniform, and we've got telegrams to send home.
I didn't get one.
I always said to Neil, if I go away and I come back, I'm sending no telegram, I'm just going to walk in. And our father always said, he says, he'll walk into this door. So I sent no telegram. I just said, righto. So we got our gear there and sorted out. Got a bob or two. And we got put on the train. Took it up in London and put on a train there. And from there, I went home. But little did I know that Mr. Quinn, Nellie's father, was waiting, well, they were all waiting.
I'll wait for four nights. Four days.
Because I didn't say when I was coming on the thing, you see? And I
stepped off a train,
and I had my daughter, June, my wife had June with her, my daughter, and she ran straight to me.
All the soldiers
that
was there.
All the soldiers got off the train. She ran to me. It must have been an instant recognition.
Yeah, a photo.
There was a photo there. Nellie's father used to stand her up and face the photo overnight. Go on, Nellie, you carry on.
On the side. Not you.
No, you.
No, you carry on because you've got the microphone.
Sure.
Well, he used to stand her up on the table every night, and she had to salute me before she went to bed. And she must have recognized me from that photograph. She ran straight to me.
What condition were you in by the time you got home?
Fit. Fit. I was fit.
Why were you so fit?
Because we'd walked 1,100 kilometers. We didn't have too much food. We had enough food to keep the body going, and I was definitely fit.
What feelings have your experiences left you towards the Germans?
Must I answer that?
Not if you don't want to.
You can't swear. Don't swear.
Well, I say the only... Well, I wouldn't say 100% of them, but I say 80% of them, the Germans, the only good German is a dead German. I'm sorry to be so blunt. Well, as I say, that's my feeling. That's my feeling. Maybe I've got a jaundiced view. Not so much for myself, but for that poor people that are seen being brought down to the level that they were brought down to, I could never understand it.
Did you not meet any decent Germans?
One or two were decent. That small chap used to come down the line shouting, "Alan Aberdeen, another horse to kill." He was a decent German.
In what way?
Well, he would see the man. He would see the other man's point of view. He maybe wouldn't agree with it, but he could see it, which to me was halfway there. That was halfway there. Because I've met some bad British soldiers. Very, very bad men. So it wasn't that the Germans had this all to themselves. Such was not the case.
Any other decent Germans you came across?
No. I would never let myself be taken in with them.